A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll hear the first in a series of two interviews with concertmasters of some of the top U.S. orchestras, beginning with David Kim of the Philadelphia Orchestra. We'll talk about his upcoming performance with the West Windsor, New Jersey-based orchestra Sinfonietta Nova, life as a concertmaster, and his commitment to teaching and working with young and amateur musicians. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Jane Chu, chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, announced she will step down at the end of her term this June. Chu praised the agency for supporting programs that connect people, help communities of all sizes thrive, and provide opportunities for children to expand their artistic and academic skills. Her successor will have to be named by President Trump, whose past two budget proposals have called for the elimination of the agency. The famed Gibson Guitar Company has filed for bankruptcy in an effort to get rid of unprofitable divisions and turn its finances around. According to Bloomberg News, the Chapter 11 filing will enable Gibson to get out of the home entertainment field it entered in 2014 in an attempt to diversify. Bloomberg reported that losses in that business, along with strained relations with suppliers and retailers and new regulations on the importation of rosewood, frustrated bondholders and creditors. Gibson guitars have been used by musicians including B.B. King and Jimmy Page. Supporters of Westminster Choir College have created a new foundation to raise funds, support the renowned choir college's legacy, and explore other options for its future. The Westminster Foundation, created by alumni and other supporters, will monitor Rider University's plans to sell the choir college to Beijing-based Kaiwen Educational Technology Company, formerly Jiangsu Zhongtai Bridge Steel Structure Company. The foundation will also work to ensure that students continue to have access to Westminster's music and education programs, regardless of any future sale. Robert Annis, who retired from Westminster in 2014 after serving as dean for 20 years, was named the foundation's president. I spoke with him about what he hopes the foundation will accomplish and what motivated him to become involved.
Westminster is an important institution. It plays an integral role in education, in the music world, and in the fabric of society. I think that's important to me. Westminster is also an institution that has many, many individuals far and wide who really hope the choir college can continue to thrive in the future. And also, I was there for a little over 20 years working at the institution. So I'm close to the institution. I think the foundation has a good perspective in terms of trying to just be supportive of making sure the choir college has a strong, thriving future.
As you've been hearing about the plans that Rider has been drawing up over the last now just over a year and a half now when it first became public, what have some of your concerns been?
Part of it is just the uncertainty, the lack of clarity. I think on the surface, the intentions that Rider has stated are positive in terms of trying to find a partner that will continue the legacy of the choir college. But at the moment, there's not a lot known. And some of the things that are known just lead you to develop fears, whether they're justified or not. I mean, Kaiwen is a for-profit company, and once a sale occurs or a transition occurs, Kaiwen's going to be able to basically do whatever they want, from my sense, and they're going to be in a position of having to answer to investors. So because so little is known about the deal, in the terms of the specifics, it's really creates this uneasiness. As a for-profit company, my sense is that Kaiwen is going to need to generate some type of a positive results because they'll have to answer to investors. And does that mean that the pressures of being a for-profit company could lead them to just change the complete direction brand of the choir college? So I think that leads to the concerns. And, you know, there is a founding mission that was pretty solid and included service. And will they understand that and embrace that? Will they work to strengthen some of the programs that were always a challenge to us in terms of the numbers, you know, sacred music and organ and piano. So it's more the uncertainty and the unknown, and even with specifics of a deal down the road, if a for-profit company needs to listen to investors, what changes will that mean?
What are the main goals of the foundation?
Obviously, the efforts are to work to be supportive, securing a future for the choir college. Ultimately, if the foundation is successful in raising some funds, I'm sure my understanding is that the foundation would like to be able to, if there is a future for the choir college, support the students through scholarships and supporting programs to, again, further the institution going forward. And I think it's also important that the foundation believes that it wants to promote the choir college in the music and educational world through networking, and also to try and provide a forum or an opportunity for, you know, supporters, alumni, benefactors, friends, organizations to link together and share efforts for not only the choir college, but creating a great environment for the students. And linked to that is the keeping the conservatory and continuing and adult education programs going. For me, I was there, as I said, for a little over 20 years. And while we grew in a very positive way through those 20 years, there was still and still is much to do and many opportunities presenting itself. And I'm hoping the foundation can be supportive of whatever the future is going to bring for the choir college. It's more than my just caring deeply about the school. I think there are many individuals that care deeply about the school, and I think there are not having specific answers to know exactly what the future is going to bring is leading to uncertainty. Hopefully, more information will be coming forward, and the various constituencies can come together and talk and have a healthy, positive future for the choir college.
That was Robert Annis, president of the newly formed Westminster Foundation. Rider University spokeswoman Christine Brown said the university is working collaboratively with foundation members. In its own update, Rider has said that Kaiwen is working with Westminster to create a program for adults in the sacred music field in China to study at Westminster this summer, as well as other possible exchanges to train Chinese church musicians and choral conductors. According to Rider, following a sale to Kaiwen, Westminster would be run by a nonprofit registered in New Jersey and overseen by a 7-person board of trustees. Rider began seeking a buyer for Westminster in the spring of 2017 after facing opposition to an initial plan to move Westminster's programs to the main Rider campus in Lawrenceville and sell Westminster's Princeton campus, part of a plan to stabilize Rider's own finances. More information on the foundation is available at westminsterfoundationprinceton.org, and updates on Westminster are also available at rider.edu/WCC update. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. With spring comes commencement and new beginnings for graduates of music schools and conservatories. For the next few weeks, we'll hear from established musicians about what they will be imparting to graduates at commencement ceremonies, or how, in other ways, they help inspire and motivate young musicians. We'll start this week with David Kim, concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, who will be appearing as a soloist with Sinfonietta Nova, a community orchestra based in West Windsor, New Jersey, and conducted by Gail Lee. Such appearances are not unusual for Kim. He has performed with a number of youth orchestras, including the Youth Orchestra of New Jersey and the Philadelphia Youth Orchestra. In addition, he founded and actively participates in the David Kim Orchestral Institute of Cairn University, which offers instruction, masterclasses, and career coaching for musicians ages 15 and older in the summer. Kim was born in Carbondale, Illinois, and has been playing violin since the age of 3. He studied with Dorothy DeLay, received his bachelor's and master's from the Juilliard School, and in 1986, he was the only American violinist to win a prize at the International Tchaikovsky Competition. He was appointed concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra in 1986, and he now serves on the orchestra's board as well. I spoke with Kim about his commitment to working with young students and other amateur musicians, the messages and lessons he tries to convey, and his thoughts on the future of classical music.
I think it's safe to say that I'm an extrovert and that works with young people and youth orchestras. And I'm always, during rehearsals, I'm talking to them, telling them stories, giving them anecdotes, tips, and things like that. And so it fits my personality to work with young people. And I also love to teach. And so I do find that these opportunities when I'm playing with youth orchestras are teaching moments. And the conductors are always unfailingly gracious and allow me to speak directly to the students. And, you know, frankly, a lot of them are, a lot of the kids come to the orchestra. They're fans of the Philadelphia Orchestra. So they're kind of excited to be working with one of the members of the orchestra. And so it just, all of that kind of works together. And usually I'm playing something pretty standard like Tchaikovsky Concerto or Brahms Concerto. And then it's a nice time to just kind of share and have fun. And then the camaraderie is there. And then the concert is more relaxed and fun. And those are the kind of ingredients that go into that formula.
Well, what do you hope that the musicians or students take away from their experience?
Well, I think not a ton of information, like, you know, a million different tidbits and facts and all that, but just kind of a general inspiring and fun performance experience, and maybe a few little practical tidbits. But overall, especially for the young people, a feeling that, wow, you know, we just played this really strong, whatever, Brahms Concerto with a professional, and it was so collaborative and inspiring and, you know, boost of confidence. All those things kind of make me feel like I hope that they take that feeling away from each performance.
You've spoken in past interviews about, you know, your early years of playing violin and learning, studying violin, and the intense pressure you felt, at least at the beginning. How has that impacted your interactions with young musicians?
Well, I mean, if I talk about my upbringing, which I often do, and even in rehearsal, I might say something like, oh my goodness, when I was 8 years old and doing 5 hours a day, you know, I get lots of knowing grins and head nods. And obviously there's a lot of kind of high achieving kids that play instruments, that play in, you know, orchestras like Youth Orchestra of Southern New Jersey or North of Bucks County or Philadelphia Youth Orchestra. Those are really high achieving kids. They study hard, yet they're excelling on their instruments. They might be a chess champion. They might also, you know, run track and swim. You know, they're all high achievers. But there's also the element of perhaps a bit of a stage parent in the background, helping to motivate them, push them. And so we all have our own stories, but it's nice for them to hear that, Mr. Kim also had the pushy mom, and he also cried because he hated practicing when he was 6 years old. And, you know, that kind of stuff really resonates. And, of course, there's the Asian connection. There are a lot of Asians that are playing in these orchestras, and we all have the same kind of Asian mom syndrome.
There's so much discussion nowadays about, you know, where classical music is going. How do you see on the ground the future of classical music in terms of, you know, these students and what they represent and what they could represent?
Well, obviously, the vast majority of them are not going to go into music as a vocation. They'll play for pleasure, and some of them will end up playing in community orchestras. Some of them will be teachers. Some of them will go into, you know, maybe play jazz and purely for enjoyment. I think it's nice to think that they will also hopefully become patrons of the arts as well. And the arts just do not function anymore without people contributing from their resources, time, resources, passion for the arts, passion for their particular favorite organization, whether it be the ballet company or whether it be the orchestra or the museum. None of that works without people giving. And I think these folks, these kids are going to grow up and understand that paradigm. And that's very, very heartening to me. And then also, I disagree with all these people that constantly say, oh, the demise of classical music. I disagree. I think the arts are here to stay, and I don't think I don't buy into that whole thing, like, oh, the arts are dying, symphony orchestras are dying. Of course, there are always shifts happening here and there, but I don't think the Philadelphia Orchestra is in danger, or neither is St. Louis Symphony or San Francisco Symphony or, you know, Asheville Symphony. I mean, I could just go down the line, and European orchestras and opera companies and dance companies and museums, and I think the arts are alive and well, and if you look at the numbers, the arts contribute much more to the local economy of Philadelphia, even than sports teams, and also ways that are unseen, local restaurants and hotels and parking and all this. It's a tremendous boon to the local economy, and so I happen to be an optimist, and I think that the Philadelphia Orchestra and orchestras like it are going to be okay.
And at what point in your career did you really decide that you wanted to make education and outreach an important part of that?
I took that role on pretty early. I had a chamber music festival that I founded in 1989 at the University of Rhode Island. And almost immediately, I realized that I was not going to be able to get as much support from the local business community if I weren't doing my part. And so as a founder, director, I started going into schools and playing, and they would go home. These kids would go home, usually third, fourth graders, and say to their dads, you know, this violinist came to my school today, and he gave me 2 free tickets to his concert, and I want to go to that concert. Can you drive us? You know, that kind of thing. And then when it came time for giving, they would say, hey, our company's going to give. That guy was at my children's school. And so shortly after I founded the festival, I started that kind of pattern, and it's grown. And now that festival is celebrating 30-year anniversary, and every year during the winter, there's a huge outreach program. Chamber music groups go off, and a lot of Philadelphia area musicians have played. So it was pretty early, and at that time I was in my 20s.
Well, you were certainly ahead of the game in terms of where the music industry was going, because now that's something that a lot of orchestras are just making part and parcel of their regular seasons. Philadelphia certainly is doing quite a lot of community outreach and engagement. What are your thoughts in terms of the ways that not just Philadelphia, but orchestras in general are basically doing the same thing, going out to the community, reaching out and bringing people in?
I wish it had happened earlier. I think that for the longest time, many, many decades, I think especially the big American orchestras kind of rested on their laurels and their traditions and thought that they could just sit back and let record royalties pay the rent and keep the lights on. And then suddenly life changed in the United States and in fact around the world. And so I think now we must be more innovative, and we must be more kind of changing with the times, and more high tech, more looking into the future. And I think that that's a good thing. We want to be challenged. We don't want to just sit there and play Beethoven symphonies every single week for the same audience in the same concert hall. I think we want to be out in the community. I think we want to be playing at Girard College on Martin Luther King Day. I think we want to be playing, you know, if we go to Israel, as we are in a few weeks, I think we do want to be at a school and playing for young people. And we want to be stretching. We want to be playing in a kibbutz. We want to be playing for Palestinians. We want to stretch every single part of what we're doing in order to grow. Because, the old saying, if you're not innovating and changing things, you're not growing.
Turning back a little bit to your career trajectory, when you switched your focus from looking for a possible career as a soloist and started looking for concertmaster positions, you were invited to audition for the Philadelphia Orchestra. But I was wondering, when you were just starting out on that search, did you have a dream or a goal orchestra in mind, or were you open to different possibilities?
That's a great question. One I'm not really asked much, especially anymore. Now I've been on the job for almost 20 years. I had a weird combination of being super naive and thinking that I could just land a job, no problem. And also this kind of inferiority complex, thinking, oh, I'm never going to get a huge job. So at the time that I was auditioning for Philly, the Met Opera was also looking for a concertmaster, and they were about to schedule me for, I think, 2 trial weeks. And then I came to Philly, and then during my two trial weeks, I was offered the position. So I never got to play at the Mets. But before I came to Philly, I was in Dallas as associate for one season. And then before that, I was auditioning for many different jobs, Chicago Symphony Concertmaster, Cincinnati, New Jersey Symphony, with no success at all, not even getting out of the first round. And so I just wanted to get a job. I just needed to have some success. And I had had so much, so many wonderful experiences and success as a young violinist. And so growing up and having every advantage and wonderful opportunities, I naively thought that I would continue to receive all those opportunities and everything as I went into adulthood. But there comes a time when a child prodigy kind of, or at least some people thought I was a child prodigy, there comes a time when it's kind of a time when you have to decide, well, is it really going to happen? Am I really going to be a soloist and achieve all those great accolades that those big, I mean, really go to the A level? Or am I going to not settle, but am I going to have a little bit more stability in my life and maybe even get a real job? And so, yeah, that was a moment for me that was eye-opening and long overdue. It happened when I was in my early 30s. I should have come to that realization that I wasn't going to be a famous soloist or anything. I should have come to that realization much sooner than I did.
Well, certainly being concertmaster is a little bit more than being a member of an orchestra and more than, you know, just being a soloist. It has other duties and responsibilities. How have you taken those roles and really shaped them as you've spent time in Philadelphia?
Well, I'm always learning. I'm my 19th season, and what I've finally come to realize is that you never stop learning. It's musical lessons to be learned, but it's also human lessons to be learned on relationships, dealing with conflict, being a good listener, knowing when to put your foot down, when to be collaborative, just all those kind of subtle things that they never teach you that you have to learn by just doing it. And I'm never really comfortable. It's kind of one of those things that, as my predecessor, the great Norman Carroll, told me, you're only comfortable when you retire. But until that point, you know, it's a difficult position. There are a lot of subtleties, and it's tough. It's tough being at the top of such an incredibly intense and superb organization where every single colleague cares deeply and has spent their entire lives preparing for that moment.
Describe your average week as concertmaster at Philadelphia.
On our 2 days off, Sunday and Monday, I'm usually preparing, you know, about 2-3 hours of practice, preparing for the following week's new repertoire. And then we have usually 4 rehearsals of 2 or 2.5 hours, usually 2.5 hour rehearsals, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. That's about 8 hours of rehearsals. And then we have 3 concerts, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So there's kind of a trajectory. Tuesday morning is kind of a little nervous, starting the new week, maybe a guest conductor, maybe Yannick is on the podium. And then getting through the rehearsals, making lots of adjustments. Then during the week, it might also be a bowing session with my principal second, Kim Fisher, and principal viola, CJ Chang, preparing for music that's maybe a month or 2 out. And then concerts, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, as I mentioned. But then there's also board meetings. I'm on the board of the orchestra. It could be development committee meetings, which I'm co-chair of. Could be golf committee meeting of that event, which I'm also a part of. You know, it's just so many other things. Every night at the concert, nearly every night, I have guests from the board or patrons come back to my dressing room, a little champagne toast at intermission. I might be playing golf on a Saturday afternoon with a board member or a patron. It's just overwhelming and never ending.
Well, turning back to the Sinfonia Nova concert, you will be playing the Tchaikovsky Concerto. What are some of the things you enjoy about coming back to that one?
Well, it's definitely my most comfortable piece and favorite, and the one I've played the most of all the major concertos. And that is because I won that prize, the 1986 Tchaikovsky competition. And I've played it so many times all over the world, many times with Philadelphia Orchestra. And so I love it the most. It feels the most comfortable. And so any opportunity to play it, I welcome. And Gail is a great friend, and She's very excited about her orchestra, and so I wanted to bring my best repertoire, and so I asked right away for Tchaikovsky.
Are there any other experiences in terms of education and working with young musicians that you're looking ahead to in the future?
I always look forward to every June. I have an orchestral institute that I founded in Langhorne at Cairn University, which is a wonderful Christian college north of Philadelphia. And this will be our third season, and I invite young violinists and violists from around the United States. And they come for a week, and they study with members of the Philadelphia Orchestra, my colleagues. But also I've invited people from Los Angeles Philharmonic, Chicago Symphony, Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, National Symphony, Pittsburgh Symphony, the American String Quartet. All these fantastic friends and colleagues come, and just it's total immersion for a week. And we have from high schoolers all the way up to professionals who come for coaching, mock audition, private lesson, seminars, and also a little bit of sharing about spiritual things, spiritual, and a chance for me to share about my Christian faith. And it's just it's something that is so rewarding, and I'm so happy to share that with young people.
Well, as we spoke briefly about earlier, being a professional musician nowadays really encompasses more than just scheduling gigs, at least for more and more.
That's right.
The entrepreneurship, the education, the outreach. What are some pieces of advice you would give to young, or you do give to young musicians about how to prepare for that aspect of becoming a musician?
Well, I think that when I'm giving advice to young people, one of the things I say is you have to create your own opportunities. If you wait for the phone to ring, if you wait for people to ask you, invariably, it's not as much as you need or want. So you have to be creative and create performance opportunities, whether that's at a church or at a retirement community, or whether it's at your alma mater, or whether it's for the local French language school, ESL, or, just there's so many opportunities out there, but you have to create them. And also to be ready to do anything, whether it's to be strolling violin in an Italian restaurant for a night, or whether it's to play at somebody's birthday party, or whether it's to play in the back of the section as a sub for some local orchestra, or to be playing string quartets at somebody's wedding. Or, just be ready to try anything. And through all those experiences, then you are ready to start narrowing it down later in life and see what really fits you.
That was David Kim, concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, who will be the soloist in the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto with Sinfonia da Nova, Sunday, May 6th. More information on the concert can be found at sinfoniadanova.org, and you can read more about Kim at davidkimviolin.com. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on La Tempo, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.